Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Joining me in studio right now is Aspen Mattis. Aspen is the author of the international best-selling memoir, Girl in the Woods, published by HarperCollins in 2015. Called a powerful read by O, the Oprah magazine, the book made The Guardian's annual top 50 list. The New York Times named Aspen Mattis a hero. Tell you why. After being raped on her second night at college, Mattis dropped out, depressed and shocked that her school did not believe and protect her. She sought solace in a remote wilderness. She found the Pacific Crest Trail and hiked the footpath's entire length, over 2,000 miles from Mexico to Canada. Inspired by the beauty and turmoil enveloping her on the trail, the author wrote poems, personal accounts, and dispatches from her tent. After moving to New York City, she published a popular account of her experiences in the New York Times Modern Love column to outstanding praise, which led to her memoir. Mattis's writing has been published in The Times, Tin House, Psychology Today, Salon, and Marie Claire. She also appears frequently on national radio and TV, including CBS, Al Jazeera, HuffPost Live, and NPR. The face of RAIN's 2015 campaign, that's the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, the nation's largest anti-sexual violence organization and a member of PEN America, RAIN's Speakers Bureau, and HarperCollins' Speakers Bureau, Mattis has become an advocate for trauma survivors. She is donating 5% of her book, Girl in the Woods, profits to RAIN. Television rights for Mattis's memoir were purchased by New Normal, and a scripted TV series is in the works. She now lives in New York City, where she is working on a novel and attending Columbia University. She's in town right now speaking at Michigan Tech, but I had a chance to bring her into the studio to be able to talk to us, and I really appreciate that she did. Aspen, welcome to the program.
Rick, thank you so much for having me.
Now, I seem like I know a lot about you now that I read that intro, but I want to kind of go back to a little bit to the beginning there. Talk about where you were entering college at Colorado College, just where you were in life and in the things that you were looking forward to.
Yeah, so I grew up in Newton, Massachusetts, which is about 2,000 miles away from Colorado Springs, Colorado, where I went to school. And I picked that school because I'd spent summers visiting my grandma there with my family and going backpacking, and I loved it, and I thought it was beautiful, and I felt connected to, like, the nature, and I thought that this would be kind of an oasis as it was in my summers. And I have to say I was probably kind of a young 18. I'd never really had a boyfriend, and I was fairly innocent, as 18 goes, and basically I wanted the same things that most 18-year-olds want, to make friends and to, like, be independent and to, like, you know, prove to the world that I was, like, a competent adult.
What did you want to go to school for?
I thought to be a writer. I thought creative writing. I was going to, I guess, concentrate in creative writing in the English major.
Okay. Yeah. So your first day of college, if you can remember your first day, what was that like?
I can hardly remember my first day. It was disorienting. There was a video dance party on the lawn, and tons of parents and people moving in. Yeah.
That experience is probably, if I was to ask anybody, can you remember your first day of college? And that would become a big blur. And the reason why I asked that is after the second day, everything changed. Talk about that.
Yeah, I certainly remember at least moments of the second day very well. I was brand new. I just arrived, and I hadn't yet removed my colorful construction paper name tag from my dorm room door, and there had been a fire drill, really, not like a real fire, but we were all out on the lawn, and we met each other, and the sprinklers were going off, and the fire truck's lights were spinning, and I met a girl and two boys, and one of them happened to be my neighbor, and we all went back to my room, which was a single, to watch The Breakfast Club. And when the movie ended, two of the boys left, the girl and one of the boys left, and one of the boys stayed. And that night, my second night of my freshman year, before classes had even begun, it was a Sunday, I was raped.
The following that, did you take this to the school?
Yeah, but not as quickly as I wish I had, or I don't know if it would have made a difference, actually. But I, in the immediate aftermath, I didn't really, I was pretty much in a kind of cold, hard denial to myself. Like, I think I showered a lot. I told the girl who had been there, and she was upset and sweet, but really, I think she asked me if I wanted her older boyfriend to beat him up, and I was like, no, I didn't. And eventually, about 2 weeks later, I went to what they call the college's rape response coordinator. And I remember that at the time, it totally blew my mind that a tiny little campus of 2,000 students would even need a rape response coordinator, that would be a job that was necessary. And in retrospect, I know, of course, it's tremendously necessary, and in a way that's even scarier. That's, you know, now I know that approximately 1 in 4 college women will be sexually assaulted during their educations, and most of them in the first 2 weeks of their freshman or sophomore year. They call it the red zone. It's a time so dangerous and so violent that it actually now has a slang name that police and the media use, the red zone. But at that time, I knew none of this, and I thought it must have been like a very unusual thing. I didn't think that rape could possibly be common. And I went to her and I told her what had happened, and she told me basically I had 3 options. I could go to the police, but I'd waited too long, so it was too late for physical evidence to still exist, and therefore I probably had no case. And she kind of cast that in a very bad light and sort of discouraged that, the going to the police. Or I could do nothing, or, which was obviously a bad option, for all the obvious reasons, or I could go through what they called the school's conflict mediation process, which she made sound like, you know, he would be expelled and, you know, there would be justice, and she made it sound like the most appealing option. And of course, at the time, I didn't realize that colleges have an inherent conflict of interest, especially the small liberal arts school. You know, no one wants a rape conviction on their campus, and they would rather, my school really didn't want me to go to the police. They would rather there be a boy assaulting girls on their campus than it be known that a rape happened on their campus, which is really disturbing to think about.
Hmm. So all during this time, you're still going to classes, you're still trying to earn your degree and go about your college life too.
I was still going to class, and amazingly, I was doing okay. I mean, I think I wasn't as there as I would have been. I was certainly not there. I was elsewhere, but I was still doing it. Yeah.
How long did this go on? You're going through this mediation process. Did that happen quickly, or was that drawn out?
You know, in terms of weeks, I'm not sure how long it was. It was probably something like a month.
Okay.
But it wasn't like daily. It was usually like, you know, I kind of narrated my testimony to the rape response coordinator, who transcribed it and filed it, and then we were assigned a mediator. And I guess the boy wrote his testimony, and then the mediator called me in to the student center upstairs, to a long folding plastic table where there was the mediator and then a mediator in training, as if this were something like a learning experience for someone, like observing, and there was the rape response coordinator and me, and the rape response coordinator just kind of asked me lots of questions, and one of the questions that she asked was, so you guys had been smoking marijuana, and we had, and I said yes, but, and I think I, like, even, big mistake, tried to make, like, a joke, like, the Bill Clinton kind of joke, like, but I tried not to inhale. And she kind of, like, looked very serious, and she wrote something down on her notepad, and she said, marijuana is a hallucinogen, and the implication was that I had hallucinated rape. And basically, I don't know the actual reason that they they dismissed the case and found the boy to be innocent, but they did. They found him to be innocent. And which meant that I was guilty of lying. And they allowed him to remain on campus. And this is actually the most baffling detail of all, and I still don't understand what they were thinking. About 6 weeks after, I learned that they had moved him, the boy, out of his dormitory, which was the other large dormitory on the other side of campus, and they'd moved him into my dormitory after all of this, the floor directly above me. And I would see him in the hallway and in the elevator and, like, all the time. And so I called campus housing and I asked to be moved farther away from him, and they moved me off campus. So at that point, I really realized that my school was not going to help me, and my parents really couldn't help me. There was really nothing they could do. And I had to help myself, and I had to leave this place.
And so you decided to leave school?
Yep, I decided that I was going to try, I was going to leave school, and I was going to try to physically, literally reclaim my body, really, and my life by backpacking from Mexico all the way to Canada, walking the entire way along a continuous footpath through the wilderness called the Pacific Crest Trail.
Now, why did that appeal to you as a form of therapy?
Yeah, so it seems like the absolute last thing that many people would do after they'd been hurt, especially, like, you know, a young woman vulnerable in, like, the deserts and the mountains of America. But in my mind, and, you know, I can't say that I was rational in this state of trauma, and anywhere was better than school, and it just seemed like a place I knew of and a thing to do. That seemed really like the only path back to my innocence or, like, my childhood, because every summer we would go backpacking and my dad would catch fish and my mom would fry the fish and we'd sleep in the tent and my dad would tell us stories in the tent and my big brother would be there and we were just like this little wild tribe and I loved it. Like, we were a really outdoorsy family and an athletic family, and it was sort of like the oasis of my childhood, and it seemed like this trail, which I knew of, and which actually I'd hiked a section of before, in which my brother, my oldest brother and his wife had backpacked a section of, it seemed like that was like a pristine place.
So you spent about 6 months out on this trail. It's 2,000 miles long, all the while writing and putting your thoughts down on paper, which eventually then becomes your book that you have here, Girl in the Woods. I'm talking with the author right now, Aspen Mattis. And you said that there was a prologue there that you wanted to read. That would be a good time.
Oh, I would love to. So Girl in the Woods is really, it's the story of the rape that occurred on my second day of my freshman year of college, and the aftermath, which was a pilgrimage, really. It was a wilderness journey alone at 19, backpacking, hiking from Mexico to Canada through California and Oregon and Washington State. And this little excerpt is really a life or death situation. It was one of the few times, and there were actually a few, all cataloged in the story, when I could have died and almost died. For days, I'd seen no one. But I wasn't scared of the solitude. Peopleless wilderness felt like the safest place. The snowfield sloped downhill and I began to run. My gait was wild now, careless, heels punching the glassy ice. My hard step shot cracks through the ground like a hammer to windshields. My impact shattered the world again, again. I was enjoying the pop sound of the cracking ground, the jolt of breaking through that extra inch. Then I fell through into the snow, up to my neck. My heart stopped. I wriggled to free my arms. They wouldn't budge. The snow's coarse grain abraded me, tearing painfully into my limbs. I had to make it out of this girl-deep hole. I struggled. I squirmed. I needed to fight. With all my power, I had to free myself. And then with one slick thrust, I popped my two arms free. They were throbbing, snow-scraped and red. I was wearing only thin black running spandex and a polypro short-sleeved shirt. I hadn't planned to be stuck 15 minutes in the snow. I tried to push myself the rest of the way free, but my legs were stuck. I couldn't shift my feet, even an inch. I couldn't feel my heels. I thrashed. It did no good. I pressed my hip left into the snow. Even as it burned me, I held my core against it until the hole melted wider, harder, into dripping ice. As the hole widened and my body heated, my right foot cooled, freezing and then burning. I struggled to move a toe, feel the brush of one shifting against another. I knew how easily I could lose my foot. In an instant, the mountains had morphed from my playground into my death trap. Even with all the survival skills I'd mastered in my 1,000 miles of walking, past basking rattlesnakes I'd stepped over like sticks, the glass-eyed bears, the shame and weight of my secret. After everything, this silly, threatless, snowy spot could be where I, just 19 years old, a dark dot of body in boundless whiteness, would end. I violently wanted to live. Chinese proverb says that a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. This journey had begun with the coercion of my body, with my own wild hope. I'd walked into the desert alone in search of beauty and my innocence lost. And strength. I had taken 2.5 million steps in the direction of those things to get here. Now, up to my neck in a hole in a field of snow in remote mountains, all I felt was stuck. This is the story of how my recklessness became my salvation.
That's from Girl in the Woods. I'm talking right now with author Aspen Mattis. Aspen, very moving.
Thank you.
I want to encourage people to get the book as I'm, you know, looking at it here. This is not a little pamphlet. This is a full-size novel. It's, you know, if it's any of it's as good as and powerful as what you just read, I'm sure it's going to be one of those you cannot put down. During this, you describe your experiences while being out in the wilderness for 6 months, rediscovering yourself. I'm told you had run-ins with rattlesnakes, bears, and other people, too, while you're there, because you're not the only person that travels that trail, and so it'll be interesting to find out, and I don't want to give too much more of the book away, because I want people to buy it, what I do want to ask, though, with our few minutes left here is, after you've completed this journey, and of course, you come back, and you start putting these thoughts together, when we read your bio earlier, you are no longer a victim. you are somebody who is, you know, championing for, you know, your cause. And talk a little bit about that, about, you know, what, you know, how this has transformed you and how you're using it to help people.
Yeah, so my rape was not the end of my life. It was really the beginning of something bigger. And I can't imagine my life right now had I not thru-hiked the Pacific Crest Trail. And it's going to sound like a strange thing to say, and I hope it doesn't come out wrong. Of course, I would never wish that I had been raped or wish that such a traumatic thing happened to anyone, but I'm glad that it happened, because my life would be, it would be tame, and it would, or maybe it wouldn't be tame, but I wouldn't feel the fire that I now feel and the need to share, like the wisdom that I've gained through this pain. And I think my purpose now in writing is to tell the truth, like the idiosyncratic and dark and gritty actuality of what it's like to be assaulted, and not just for my own catharsis, though it was tremendously healing and cathartic, but also for the purpose of providing a map for girls and anyone who feels like this is tremendously dangerous, mapless terrain, as I felt, and needs to know that this is not the end of their life. It's something that they will survive, and also that a rape is never your fault, and it doesn't matter if you were smoking weed or if you were drunk. Short shorts don't cause rape. Marijuana doesn't cause rape. Rapists cause rape. No one causes rape but rapists. And it's really that clear. And I needed to hear that.
Where are you in your life now? We started where you were when you were 18. How is Aspen doing right now, apart from the book and apart from the speaking tours?
Apart from the book, well, I'm doing really well. I live in Greenwich Village in Manhattan, New York, and I am a student at Columbia University, and I'm working on a novel, and I write every day, and I've contributed to The Atlantic and The New York Times, and I'm very interested in philosophy and poetry, and yeah, I don't think this is another thing that might, I hope, not come out wrong, but I don't think about my rape in terms of like nightmares or like something. I've processed it, I would say. Like, I, in writing the book, really, I think more than in hiking the trail, in writing the book, the hiking the trail helped me in that it put me into a situation. See, I thought I would be alone in this pristine wilderness, and I was like, good riddance to, you know, I couldn't navigate the world of frat boys, so my solution was to run away from it. But in actuality, I ran to the one place in America, except for maybe the military, might be the other place, where men multiply and women divide. There are actually 10 men who attempt to thru-hike the Pacific Crest Trail for every one woman, and there are about 400 people who attempted it my year. So almost all of them were men, and the women were mostly in couples. There were a few exceptions who I met, but just tons and tons more males than females. And so again and again and again, I was in a position where I was vulnerable to strangers who were male. And again and again and again, I found that these people respected me. There was nothing bad happened. And if I said I didn't want to do something, either, you know, intimate or just like in terms of like I wasn't comfortable climbing that mountain more often, people honored that they weren't like, they didn't try to make me feel bad about my boundaries. They didn't violate me in any way. And instead, they were very protective and compassionate generally and really just kind. And what the through hike taught me, I thought I was running away from men, but really I was running into the woods with men, so much more vulnerable to anyone who would take advantage. And what it taught me was that most people won't, and that rape is not normal. And I am safe in the world, in my body. And that was a tremendous gift.
Girl in the Woods, if somebody wants to get themselves a copy, how can they do that?
You can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Oh, sorry, Barnes & Noble. Yep. Or you can get it. Basically, any bookstore in America can order it, or HarperCollins.com. HarperCollins is my publisher.
Espen, thank you so much. I know this is not an easy thing to talk about, but you do it very, very well. An inspiring story, and you know, and just I feel better just having talked to you, and prouder than I know you.
Thank you. This was a wonderful conversation. Great interviewer.
Thank you. Copper Country Today. We'll be right back.